Not mine.
You gonna cut? That's it. There you go.
I don't think so. I don't even know. Like, ask a Bill or Pat. We have like, yeah, we have ways many boats.
This road out here.
We have constant problems with it. And then you gotta, like, you guys, it doesn't work in the field. We're gonna, one thing
that about being a county commissioner is not
we take all of them to Lake Austin, right below the 360 bridge, and launch them, and run them for like a
year,
just to make sure that, and then, we kind of bring them back, right away, we might clean everything up first.
I tried my email.
I guess I think let's go ahead and start back. Get some of this done. I'll get y'all nice and ready for your post-lunch nap, talking about some permit changes that are coming down the pike. The first one and the biggest one, which is really up in the air after some current events this week, is the pesticide general permit, which is coming out of TCEQ. But it's not really of TCEQ's doing. It's eventually coming from the federal level. EPA historically has not considered pesticide applications on or near waters of the United States part of their permitting program that would require a pollution elimination discharge permit. Well, in 2009, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals told them otherwise. And so now that ruling required both EPA at the federal level and any of the states that they directly regulate, plus any designated states, to have to begin to develop a general permit for pesticide applications. EPA had planned to finalize their permitting program and a general permit. And does everyone know the difference between an individual and a general permit? An individual is one that each group individually has to apply for, like the city of Waco would apply for one, and it's a fairly involved process, whereas general permit is one written by the state. Everyone pretty much has to comply. You have to do some notification to the state that you're operating under and maybe, depending on the program, take data and submit data to support that you're doing what you're supposed to. But it's a much lesser process, and this would be a general permit. And however, to date, EPA was supposed to have theirs issued in December 2010. They have not, and states were required to finalize by April of this year. TCEQ had it on their commissioner's agenda for approval on April 6th, with the permit being effective on April 9th if it had been approved. However, yesterday there was a stay of vacatur list issued at the federal level. EPA had requested a six-month stay. They were not having enough time due to the National Environmental Policy Act. They had to coordinate with U.S. Fish and Wildlife on endangered species issues before issuing any of these permits, and they had not had time to complete that process, asked for a stay, and were granted it. Email I got from TCEQ yesterday says they basically pulled it off their commissioner's agenda. They did not anticipate making any major changes to their draft permit that they were taking to the commissioners, and that the new effective date would be October 31st, so that you would probably see that going to the commissioners sometime early October of that month for approval and adoption by TCEQ. I was going to run through a brief kind of synopsis of one thing to note, and Jennifer's here, and I'm sure she'd have popped up if I didn't say it, is Parks and Wildlife does have their own state aquatic vegetation management plan. If you are applying pesticides to aquatic plants or in the waters of Texas, you are going to have to do both. You will now in the future have to apply for the pesticide general permit through TCEQ, depending on what you're doing and the level of application, but you will still have to step through this Parks and Wildlife process. We do the Parks and Wildlife process already at Granbury, and we've done it at Limestone. It's fairly simple, and I don't really anticipate the pesticide general permit does not appear to be that much worse either, unless you're dealing with some majorly heavily regulated pesticides. But and Jay Bragg from the Farm Bureau may be able to speak a little bit greater to it, but there was a bill filed in the House of Representatives this week by a representative from Ohio that's going to probably maybe negate some of this. And I don't know, Jay, if you can give a better update than that.
It's been filed, and I don't know if it'll be voted on this week or not. It's reducing federal regulatory burdens act, I think. It's H.R. 872. And basically what the rules as it reads right now, they'd have to go through and still comply with FIFR, the Federal Insecticide and Roticide Act, in addition to the NPDES. So instead of having two, basically this would strengthen FIFRA to be compliant with the Clean Water Act is the intent anyway. And so there would not be a need for the NPDES permit, general permit.
And FIFRA requirements require on the label of the pesticides whether you can use it, how far from water, whether you can use it in water, et cetera. So it's the permit would be kind of redundant, and that's why the legislation has been introduced.
And so I'd
also like to say, being from the pesticide division of the TDA, currently in the state of Texas, there are no streams impaired for pesticides that are currently used. Now, we do have some DDT and chlordane concerns in the Trinity River and down in the valley, but none of our streams on the 303D list right now for currently used pesticides have any impairments or concerns. So our applicators are doing a pretty good job.
And given that it's so up in the air, I was going to walk through it in fair good detail, but I may skim through it pretty quick unless y'all just raise your hand and say you want the intense detail of what the new permit would require. But you'd still have to get an individual permit if you're doing something not consistent with what's authorized in the general permit. It's pretty broad, and I think it covers probably 90% of pesticide uses in the state, I think. Unless you had, which Richard just told us we don't have, if you had a water body that's impaired for that particular pesticide you wanted to use, you would have to get an individual permit. You would not be able to use the general permit. If you had a water body designated as an outstanding natural resource water body, which we don't have any in the Brazos that I'm aware of, and I just looked the other day, and or if you would contribute to some other sort of impairment or violation, you would have to go through the individual process. Things that were exempt from the general permit, applications to playa lakes up in the panhandles, stock ponds, as long as it does not have a nexus to a state water, which means it's you just dug a pond out in your field and had a creek running through it or anything where it could wash downstream into state waters. Isolated wetlands or any other conveyance that doesn't have a connection to waters of the United States.
That's based on the current interpretation of what navigable streams mean.
Yes.
Under the Clean Water Act.
And not
so
out of
that.
That
could change.
Yeah, there is a revised guidance that I don't even want to begin to try to explain, because I think the EPA and the Corps of Engineers, in an attempt to simplify, made things significantly more muddled and more difficult. And so I think you'll see probably even more court cases instead of less, which was, I think, their intention, arguing over what is waters of the United States in the future. Treatment area, this was one question we did ask. Given that we own multiple lakes and from time to time, depending on what we're facing aquatic plant-wise, may have to treat different ones, each contiguous area is a single treatment area. So if we treat at Lake Granbury and then we treat at Lake Limestone, that's two different treatment areas. And the same would apply for someone with a large acreage. If you've got, as long as it's not contiguous and you've broken it up, or you've got a farm in Johnson County and then you have another one over in Hood County, those are two different treatment areas you'd be treating, unless they cross the county line in one big unit, and you're going to treat it all. At least for us, that's really helpful because you have thresholds of the amount of pesticide in the areas you can treat, and so letting each one be an individual unit gives you a lot more flexibility. The major uses in the application thresholds are here as far as what you can treat. In water, it's 100 acres in water or 200 linear miles of shoreline. You'd have to have a heck of aquatic plant problem, which not that there aren't some in the state, but to exceed that if you're just doing routine maintenance like we do on our lakes. There's also thresholds for nuisance animals, forest canopy pests, and mosquitoes. The reason some of those are so large is because mosquitoes, some of those things, insects that where aerial spraying is really only the best, it's real hard to control that. And given a lot of cities that do mosquito control in rural areas, they cover a huge amount of area. And TCEQ, well, I think they're stricter on some provisions than what the EPA's draft permit looked like. They really did try to, I think, make this the least burdensome that it can be for people. There's four levels of authorization in the proposed TCEQ permit. 1A is the most intense. You meet or exceed your application thresholds, which means you're applying it to more land than on that previous slide. You have public access. You're using a restricted use, state limited use, or a regulated herbicide. If you are a level 1A, you're going to have a licensed pesticide applicator, apply your pesticides, which, by the way, they do have courses all over the state, and they're very reasonable to get that license if you need one. You have to do a notice of intent to TCEQ prior to your treatment, and then you're going to have to submit annual reports to them about what you did. Level 1B, again, you're exceeding the thresholds. Public access if you're using a general use pesticide, or private access using one of those restricted use ones. And if you're using a restricted use, you have to have a TDA licensed applicator. That's pretty much, I don't even know that you can buy the restricted use ones without your license, I don't think. And then on the level 1B, you have to submit a self-certification form to TCEQ prior to application. They have not released that self-certification form yet, so I don't really know what that looks like to compare it against what you have to do for parks and wildlife, but I don't anticipate it being too burdensome. On a level 2, that you're applying less than the threshold, you're using, and if you're using your restricted use pesticide, again, applicator, and you're required to keep a self-certification statement on site. So we would have to keep one because our Lake Granbury treatments usually fall below this level, or maybe a big year we treat 20 acres or so. And we're usually using a general use pesticide, so we'd have to do a self-certification statement and store them. And then the final level, this is really to cover your individual homeowners, small acreage, less than 1 acre of land, general use, readily available pesticides. You follow the FIFRA label. You do what the manufacturer recommends, and you're good to go, and you don't have to do anything under the pesticide application permit. Self-certification form, I'm assuming, will be made available. This is what was going to happen if they had gone forward in April. They were going to make it available the day that the commissioners approved it, and then you were going to have a 90-day time frame to get either file your paperwork if you're a level 1A that has to get approval, or on the self-certification you'd have 90 days to get everything in order before the rule became effective. I'm going to assume they're just going to move that date out to October 31st, unless the federal government undoes some of this and it has to be rethought. That's pretty much it, unless there's any questions. And on this next set of permit updates, some of you folks from the cities and the counties may be a little more familiar with these than I am, so if I misstep, let me know, but I was trying to give everyone an idea of some of the good changes that are coming. Well, I don't know if they're good changes, but changes that are coming your way. Stormwater permits are starting to get a whole lot more look these days. Main reason, urban stormwater's a major contributor in most watersheds to impairments around the United States. According to EPA, 13% of all rivers and streams, 18% of all lakes, and 32% of all estuaries are impaired directly related to urban stormwater runoff. So you're going to see a lot of the stormwater permits and stormwater-related permits are going to get tighter and tighter and tighter, I think. And this year and the things coming down the pike we know of in the next couple of years are no different. For the MS4 permits, this is a municipal separate storm sewer system permit. You have right now your phase one and phase two permits. Phase one is large metropolitan areas, Houston, Dallas, the Metroplex, Dallas-Fort Worth area all have to have phase one, and that's an individual permit. Phase two, you heard Lucas talk, College Station, Bryan area, smaller urban area, now requiring coming in their first round and having to have those permits and start to do that. Right now, that's a general permit for the smaller urban areas, greater than 10,000, less than the 100,000 required for the phase ones. But they do have some differing requirements, too, depending on whether you're phase one or phase two. I went through urban areas, and the one thing I thought that was interesting reading these, and I went to a conference on it not too long ago, U.S. Census right now defines the urban areas, but they also have what they call the urban cluster populations, and a lot of times those urban clusters really haven't maybe reach the magnitude of a city of Waco or a Bryan College Station area, but they're still being looked at. And what I would expect that we'll see over the next probably 5 to 10 years is these urban clusters are going to start being included in requirements to have MS4 permits. I tried to make a map, and it looked really wonderful on my computer and not so wonderful here when I ran through it earlier. But some of the ones that surprised me classified as urban clusters, Grand Marais area, Cleburne's now in that group. There was Leveland is classified by the Census Bureau as an urban cluster. Muleshoe is now an urban cluster. So Georgetown area, which actually as quick as it's growing, other than it just hit between the census ranges, probably would actually be bumped up to an urban area soon. Meadville, Sealy, Prairie View. Some of these areas you don't think of as being heavily populated. They're nice medium-sized to small towns, but they're starting to come up on this, so I would expect we may start seeing them having to do a whole new level of monitoring, regulation, and things within the city that they haven't had to do in the past. In 2009, EPA proposed a national rulemaking to strengthen this program, and really the things they're going after is they want to reduce the impacts of stormwater discharges from new development and any redevelopment of existing developed areas, making other regulatory improvements to these rules. It's proposed they'll have something by late 2011 with an effective date sometime in late 2012. I don't know if that'll happen, but at least that's what's on their schedule. There are four preliminary considerations that they've published are expanding the universe of regulated discharge beyond urbanized areas. I think that's where they're hinting. They're not saying they're getting into the urban clusters, but I think that's where they're going to try to go. They're going to establish substantive post-construction requirements based on these MS4 programs. So you're going to have to go out even after something is done, it's constructed and in effect, and monitor and make sure it does not continue or nothing happens to it in the future that would cause it to contribute to stormwater. Single set of requirements. The requirements are they're trying to combine them, phase one and phase two. It's going to be the same regardless of your size. And then this is another one that's a little tricky. They want to try to address stormwater discharges from existing sources through redevelopment. So I don't know how strong they'll be there about trying to force that as far as, you know, it's one thing if you are going to go redevelop an area and revitalize something, fine, you've got to meet the new rules. But this little statement right there makes me think they're going to try to force it maybe municipality-wide, regardless of whether you're redeveloping or not, that then you're going to have to do some sort of upgrade to your system or something else to counteract what's happening on the surface of the land is the way I interpret that. They did just, issue on April 14th an improvement guide, and I did put the website up here, and we'll put all these presentations out on our CRP internet site, so if you want to go get them at a later date, you can. TCQ's in the process of reviewing this guidance to see what, if anything, they want to, need to, have to incorporate into their current programs. Big things in this guide says the permit provision should be clear, specific, measurable, and enforceable. I think there was a statement in that guidance that across states and even sometimes within states there's been a great variance as to what's required in trying to make sure that everything is clear and Houston has to do what Dallas has to do, what Waco has to do, that sort of thing. They're putting in clear performance standards. They're asking for measurable goals, basically numeric effluent limits that can be tested. Increased emphasis on the management plan for stormwater that municipalities have to do, adding in an illicit discharge detection and elimination system, an enforcement response plan when they do find illicit discharges, and a prompt update process so that it's going to be revised quickly and efficiently as needed. Increased monitoring and record-keeping requirements. Like I said, they're beefing up construction and post-construction requirements, or they're asking for it. They want proof that municipalities have the legal authority to enforce their plan so that it's actually functional and that they have the ability to acquire the resources to actually implement the plan and run it in their municipalities. Another little piece of paperwork that came out of EPA the other day, which I think is also leads me or supports the idea that I think they're going to try to expand the universe that MS4 it covers, is that there's guidance to states on developing a nitrogen and phosphorus pollution management program. In this little guidance, one of the key recommendations that they're saying is they are encouraging the expansion of MS4 programs to areas not currently covered. Was one of their key ideas for dealing with some of the urban runoff issues. Encouraged increased regulation of nutrients and discharges, so wastewater plants, any sort of industrial facility that is discharging nutrients can probably expect over the next 10 years see tighter regulations, CAFOs, and like I said, urban stormwater sources. And if I read this, and I've read it several times, they're essentially trying to establish, I think, a nationwide TMDL for nutrients. You've got to go through, assess where it's a problem, define your loadings, where they're coming from, develop a plan to reduce the loadings. It's a TMDL without the term TMDL on front of it. And it's going nationwide, so I think all those folks who've sat back, and I know we've got a few of our engineers around here crossing their fingers thinking that we're not going to have to deal with wastewater plants that are discharging nutrients, I don't think it's going away. So I think it's in everyone's future to have to deal with that. The next steps as far as TCQ is concerned, they're incorporating elements of that guidance into their permitting program. Phase one permits will be processed as they come due or as they expire. They'll be reprocessed under some of the new standards. The general permit expires on August 13th, 2012. TCQ says they expect to reissue the general permit before that date. I wouldn't be surprised if you start to see some additional MS4s regulated. I don't know that they'll take that step yet, but it's certainly hinted at very strongly in the EPA guidances. And they already have adopted some of the construction effluent limitations just by reference into the state administrative code, so you can probably start to see some of those limits, especially in your construction permit, which is what I'll talk about next. Construction general permits to prevent stormwater runoff from construction sites while they're active. This new guidance was published by EPA in December 2009. It's supposed to be effective right now. And basically, the big changes there, all sites that require permit coverage now must implement erosion and sediment controls, where there was some little language depending on the site, and it was very specific where you could avoid those. Now you're not going to be able to. And pollution prevention measurements. In this guidance, they also established the effluent limit guides, and it's kind of phased in based on the size of the construction. If you're greater than 20 acres, you're going to have to meet that August 1st of this year. Sites between 10 and 20 acres have till February 2nd, 2014 before that really becomes effective for them to get their construction general permit. But it's going to be a turbidity standard, and they are going to have to monitor it and prove that they are meeting it. Right now it's set at 280. However, somehow EPA didn't quite process their data correctly. It didn't go into it on great detail. It just made a statement that they are in the process of revising the standard. They know it. Something didn't quite go right, and however they calculated it. I'd be shocked if it's any more. Usually they don't lessen things and make them looser. So I would, if you do frequently do construction or have it going on in your site, I'd kind of plan for 280. Like I said, TCQ will have to start incorporating these into the general permit. They've already incorporated this turbidity standard by reference, so whenever EPA resets it, if it's 260 or 270, they don't have to go back and revise the administrative code. But hopefully they're saying the final rule should be published in the Federal Register by May 30th. But again, a lot of times they don't make their deadline. So it's something, if it concerns you, you may just kind of want to watch their site or check out the Federal Register to keep an eye on it for when it's actually going to be published for public comment and be effective.
Tiffany, do they know, what's the 280 based off of? Is that just EPA's numbers that they have? Or?
I think they actually did some sampling at a variety of construction sites and then developed that number, but they got, from what I can read, and it doesn't quite come out and really say it, but I think they got challenged pretty hard on the way they processed and analyzed some of that data and was found maybe to have not used some best practices, so they're having to go back and relook at it. It didn't really go into specific detail on what got goofed up, but 280 is a lot for turbidity compared to what we see in the streams, but coming off a disturbed storm site, that's going to be pretty hard for a lot of those guys to meet, especially if they've clear-cut something to build a major structure. That's going to be tough for them to capture that. And it, some of the things kind of hint that EPA may be going towards the rule that if you can't meet that standard, you're going to have to capture every bit of stormwater that falls on your site and treat it before it leaves your site. Yeah, it really sounded like that's what was where it was going in the future, probably, or some of the recommendations was if you can't meet those standards, and they were contemplating some other standards too, but they haven't gone so far as to try to actually adopt a numeric for anything other than turbidity. That's going to be a tough one for the construction guys. Depending on the area, probably very necessary and very valuable, but it'll be tough. And TCEQ's next steps on their construction general permit, from what EPA says, is all permits issued after February 1st, 2010 must incorporate the effluent limits, but the general permit has not expired yet for the state, so they'll be in the process in the 2013 timeframe of revising theirs, and that's probably the point in time when they'll actually start incorporating those construction limits. Because right now they can say it all they want, but they really don't have any legal ground to go out and force somebody who's already operating under it to change the way they're doing things. So even though EPA's beating their chest, I don't think they can force that issue on anybody until the point in time when the TCEQ's general permit has to be redone. But like I said, they've already adopted that turbidity effluent guideline into state administrative code, so it's there and it's adopted by reference, so whatever the final number is, you will probably see it in 2013 come into those construction permits. And the last one that's being updated or in the process of going through changes, multi-sector general permit. This one authorizes stormwater activities associated with industries. The applicability is determined by your SIC code or the standard industrial code for the industry. The current Texas MSGP expires August 14th of 2011. I just put a few lists based on some of our attendings on some of the types of industrial activities that are covered. Treatment work, so water and wastewater treatment, wastewater treatment plants are definitely covered. Water treatment plants, I think it's more determined case by case depending on what sort of process you're using. Anyone, transportation equipment, making transportation equipment, storing transportation equipment, transportation-related sites, steam electric operating facilities, scrap recycling facilities, landfill and land application sites, all have to be covered by one of these stormwater permits. Again, you're not probably going to be able to get one of these, or you're going to have to go get yourself an individual permit if you're discharging into an impaired water body and it's anticipated that you may be discharging the substance that it's impaired for. And you'll have to have, but they're also putting that in the general permit now that depending on what they think it may be, you may have to do some extra steps. May not be a pollutant of concern, say something's, we'll just use Richard's example, it's impaired for a pesticide. But maybe it's a concern for dissolved oxygen, and they think there's, even though you're not discharging the pesticide, they think there's something in your discharge that may work for dissolved oxygen. You may have to go and do some additional requirements to prove that your discharge is not making that worse. Benchmark changes. They've always had sampling of some level in there, but it's kind of been dependent on what your SIC code was. Now you can probably start to look to see pH, COD, TSS, and oil and grease is probably going to become standard regardless of what you do. However, they have written in a waiver. You're going to have to sample the first 2 years you're covered under the general permit, but if you're clean in those first 2 years, they'll grant you a waiver from the sampling requirements in year 3 and 4. Next steps on this one, draft permit should be available any day now, and I put the website where you can get some more information about that. The new permit effective date would be August 15th, and that'd be the first day you'd have to apply for coverage and revise your stormwater program. The last day to apply for coverage under it is the 21st. I've heard some rumblings at a meeting I went to a couple weeks ago, and I don't know if I know enough detail, but it was disturbing, was that if you have an industrial process, and we'll use a Dow Chemical down in the south, huge facility, if you have any hint of treating domestic waste in your industrial site, so they do, it's a huge site, they have their own little treatment works to treat their human waste from the site. Those two lines, their industrial discharge and their wastewater treatment plant lines, go together and go out as a single discharge. Well, if you have any hint of domestic, they're going to start adding bacteria to those sampling requirements. That's going to be real tricky given the size of their site, the amount of wildlife they have. They have two huge on-site storage reservoirs that are loaded. Any given day you look at the aerial photography, you can either see alligator heads all over it, ducks, geese, depending on the time of year. That's going to be something that's going to be really hard for people to deal with and meet. Now, that's, Dow's a big enough site. It has to have its own individual stormwater permit, so... And that apparently was something coming down from EPA, but I asked the same thing. We operate several wastewater plants. Occasionally you get critters roaming across there, too. While we've never had a discharge from stormwater that we would even begin to think has bacteria in it, suddenly you're going to have to start testing for it. And given how pervasive it is, A, in that environment, that makes me nervous, but also the fact that you do have, usually they're kind of on the outskirts of town. They're not where people want to see them, so you'd still get some infiltration by wildlife. Well, our drinking water plant, Granbury, every once in a while you'll see something paddling around one of the ponds. A little bird or something lands in there, thinks it's a nice place to be for a little bit. And as we learned in some of our talks earlier, it takes very little to cause a bacteria impairment. So that was kind of nerve-wracking as far as what they'll do to the industrial guys if there's any hint of municipal or domestic waste being treated. Overall, there's kind of a theme I'm seeing coming down from the federal government, and I'm sure you've all read it, especially if you live in the Metroplex, but you see it a lot in the papers, but you're going to start to see greater federal involvement, and they're going to start interfering, I think, more and more. And I don't know that interfering is the right word, but they're going to start strengthening up standards, and they seem to be very adamant about it. You're going to see existing permits get tighter and tighter. You're going to see expanded monitoring requirements. Like I said, I think nutrient stream standards are coming, so are nutrient discharge standards. We're already starting to see it in the construction permits, numeric effluent limitations coming in beyond what we traditionally think of in TPDES permits. Real hardcore implementation deadlines. There doesn't seem to be, historically, usually if it's a major change, they'd give you a year, 5 years, depending on the severity of the change, to get yourself up to speed, get your facilities in order, get your permits done. Doesn't seem like there's going to be that much flexibility anymore. It's going to be do it or don't, and then suffer the consequences if you don't. And it's definitely probably going to mean increased time and expense related to managing these permits and then managing the programs the permits are intended to regulate. So I think it's kind of a common theme that seems to be coming down in a whole lot of different areas. So whether some of that's good or bad, I don't know, but I think it's definitely going to happen to everyone. If there's any questions, I'll answer them. If not,
as far as, there's not a state water quality standard for turbidity, is there?
No.
So they'll have an effluent limit for turbidity though in their stormwater permit.
There might be some finished drinking water, something, but not for ambient surface water quality.
Do you think there'll be an expectation that if there's a standard for an effluent limit, that the states will be assigned a turbidity limit based on the need for that?
In surface water?
For surface water, because that's what you're talking about, right? And do you know of any other states that have a turbidity limit?
There are some that have turbidity limits.
Well, I mean, the reason I ask is that effluent limits are supposed to be technology based. And I'm not opposed. I mean, certainly those facilities need to have stormwater controls, but at the same time, that number has to be based off something.
They must be based on what they saw, like you said, they have the sites and they sampling, and they said what is reasonable for these sites to be able to contain our streams. We haven't touched on that, but it is just such. I mean, nutrients is extremely.
Yeah, and turbidity or any of the other, I know what they're going after with that standard. They're trying to, prevent solids from running off and into the streams and doing some of the things Dacus was talking about and smothering out spawning grounds, mussel beds, and everything else that it can do. But to adopt that for a surface water standard in our state is going to be extremely difficult. Even in our basin, there isn't one number that could apply well anywhere. We see, at least in our TSS, is everything from a 10 to 10,000, depending on where you're at and what rainfall's just done. Granbury's generally pretty clear, but right after a big storm, it looks like chocolate milk, and then give it a month or two, it'll clear up again. PK's even more clear. Lake Limestone always looks like chocolate milk. So,
that's what I was wondering, how you determine a state surface water standard that isn't based on ambient conditions, it's based on stormwater conditions. What's the normal, how is that 280 value to be applied to a storm situation where we're straining into a creek or stream that obviously doesn't have very high turbidity because it's a high flow condition? If chances are the bed itself is stormwater runoff in the channel.
They wanted a standard that was enforceable. They have a standard that is enforceable. There's now a number. They can't say you're letting Oh, I know. Well, 280 in the San Gabriel is a heck of a lot different than 280 going into the Navasota and the impact it's going to have.
Isn't the 280 end the pipe?
Yes.
So it's not. So it's being read before it goes into the water, right?
Well, yeah, theoretically you're supposed to be able to capture it and get a sample before it goes out into the stream. But I think just getting at the point of how do you assess a negative impact. So on that, when you probably are going to have a stream that's also loaded with stormwater that's carrying dirt just from runoff from fields and yards and wildlife areas and stuff that's already going to be high turbidity, and how do you hit that guy for causing damage when nature's doing it itself?
Right.
So, and I can't deign to understand the wisdom. All I can say is I do know that it was very clear they wanted a numeric standard that can be enforced upon, and they have a numeric standard that can be enforced upon. Some degree, I understand that mentality because it does make it crystal clear, and the construction guys are going to know, depending on where they're at and what they're doing, they're going to have to do a whole lot more or maybe a whole lot less on their sites. But it's going to be tough. I mean, I don't know. We do testing on our stormwater, usually for heavy metals and DODs at the wastewater plants, but I don't know sometimes if they're in the middle of a construction project, even a minor one where our guys are fixing something in-house, how would that be, and if it'd be below 280? I think it would. I've never seen. We're pretty tough on them and inspecting them at the wastewater plants, make sure they're not doing anything. I don't know, but I think that was the real goal, was getting something enforced. I know we've done it around here. There's been some egregious ones, and I picked up the phone and called over to Anna's office and let them know about it in the middle of a rain event. And we've seen it up around Granbury a time or two. I'd say most of the sites do just fine. They know the rules are out. worry with trying to get TCEQ out to visit them if it's not necessary, and they'll do what they're supposed to. But the ones I've seen that don't, it's really egregious. So maybe something to give them a little more meat to go after some of those maybe perpetual violators with, I don't know. But it just seems like, and we're seeing that surface water, too, with the nutrients. They're wanting numeric standards. They're going to get some numeric standards. Those do, though, is they do give you something clearly defined. So hopefully the construction guys will be innovative and find some way to work around that without it causing them too much of a problem. It's probably going to cost a little more to buy your house in a new subdivision, but it's coming down from the feds. Now I don't even begin to know who's on, next on the agenda. Is it Allison?
Allison Woodall. I'm with the TCEQ Clean Rivers Program, and I work hand-in-hand with the Brazos River Authority on them taking care of this program and making it work. Today I was going to give an update on some of the things that are going on at TCEQ with regard to water quality standards, which we've been covering, touching on all throughout all of these presentations, so there might be a little bit of overlap there. And then a little bit about the water quality assessment, but just a brief amount on that. And then about our watershed action planning process, which has to do with how do we address our impairments. And we've touched on a lot of that with watershed protection plans, so that gives you a good background. So we'll start out. So those are the three program areas or three program updates I'm going to talk about today. So the first one. Do with our water quality standards. And it may not mean a whole lot to everybody here, but at TCEQ, we have a lot of program areas, a lot of water quality program areas, a lot of water supply areas, et cetera, et cetera. Within the last few years, the water quality standards group that develops the standards for the state sets the criteria across the state that we check every single water body against. They moved into our area and is now in our section, which means coordinating even more and more, and we get to know more and more about what's going on with standards. And so we're more on top of what's, you know, down the pike, what's going on right now. And so what has happened recently is that they have gotten their standards approved through TCEQ's agenda. We mentioned that earlier today. And they submitted them to EPA. EPA still has them. And some of the major revisions that they're looking to do is updating some toxic criteria that protects human health and waters, adding numerical criteria for chlorophyll A in 75 reservoirs around the state and quite a few reservoirs here in the Brazos Basin, and I'll give you a list of those in just a minute. And that's a pretty big step. We've never had a number to assign to say, okay, we're going to look at chlorophyll A, which is the algae in the water, to see how it's responding or possibly over time or whatever, to see is this water body getting affected by the nutrients that are coming into it. Adding more levels of use for contact recreation. We mentioned this earlier as well. These are these categories from primary use, your high-use water bodies for lots of potential for ingestion, et cetera. Then there's the secondary contact one, secondary contact two, which even less potential for touching the water body. And then there's non-contact, which is basically, I think we have maybe one non-contact recreation water body in the state, and that is the Houston Ship Channel.
Victoria Barge Canal.
You don't want to get in there, huh?
And the Victoria Barge Canal.
Victoria Barge Canal, okay. Similar situation. You don't want to get in there. Get run over. And adding and revising site-specific standards for individual water bodies. And there's a few of those in the Brazos Basin, and I'll show those to you in a minute. So basically, that's where we go in and we check the use. Is it supposed to be set at this presumed use, or should we check it and see what is the appropriate use for this water body, for aquatic life, for instance, or for contact recreation. So, proposed changes, of course, standards still proposed. Until we hear from EPA to say, yes, these are approved, these are all proposed. Potentially. All right, sorry, I've got a tiny little printout here. Hard to see. So, chlorophyll A, the numeric criteria at dams, and I have a slide. I'll just go back. So this is the chlorophyll A criteria in the dams. So these are all the dams in or reservoirs in Brazos that have criteria, numeric criteria, now set for them. And these are based on historical data throughout this basin, or for each reservoir. And they said, okay, what does chlorophyll A show right now? Let's take a long-term average or a long-term median, and let's take a look at them. What this number is now is we're going to look at data that we collect over a period of up to 7 years, anywhere from 2 to 7 years, and we're going to say, is the median of that data meeting this number, threshold value for now? If it is not meeting that number, it's too high, then it will be called impaired for algae growth, and potentially they'll try to get back to the nutrients that might be affecting it and causing that. There are lots of things that can cause chlorophyll A or algae to grow. If you have a very clear lake, potentially sun can get further down and cause it to grow, or just a little bit of nutrients sometimes can cause this. So those are the list of reservoirs. Anybody have any questions about those?
Do you want to explain what the number, like the Stillhouse and Cisco and Georgetown with the five and the other numbers?
Okay, yes. So our laboratory methodology for evaluating algae in the reservoir, for evaluating chlorophyll A, they're very good, but they're not perfect. And so what the TCEQ decided to do was give a little safety factor for the whether you could trust or have confidence in the number at such a low value. These are micrograms per liter. And so the 5 was the low number we set across the state to meet. What Stillhouse Hollow, for instance, has is a 2.07 historical average. I believe it's an average, not a median. So that's really low. And for instance, Georgetown 3.87 and 4.64 for Cisco. Those are all below the 5. The 5 was that lowest minimum that we thought we could properly, accurately.
What's the lowest number you could actually have a methodology for?
There's some discussion on that.
Three
in this basin. In some basins, they say they can get lower, but we're not sure. We don't have, this is not a NELAC accredited parameter, and what that means is National Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Conference.
I was just saying, the lowest we feel like we can produce with reliability and reproducibility is a 3.
Right. And that is pretty much, that's pretty consistent across the state. Okay, next item. Several rivers or streams have dissolved solids changed. So total dissolved solids, that's your chlorides and your sulfates, your salts. And these are calculated using a long-term average. And so I'll go to those real quick. These are the river segments. Brazos below PK, they changed for TDS from 2300 to 2325. Some of them are small changes. Others are a little bit larger. This is a tiny little dot. The Nolan has changed. There's a good reason for this. A lot of the fish studies that we did said that it could withstand this kind of change. If we did not allow for this change, there might not be any water in the Nolan River due to discharges being removed. So, Salt Fork Brazos, is this the one that still, even though we've changed it, it's still not going to meet? And the
that,
Double
that
Mountain
segment,
Fork.
It's almost like a tidal. That's right up in the heart of the Pine Springs.
Yeah.
It's probably, I can't set the standard time.
It's just covered in salt. Yeah, the whole area is very salty. So, even though these numbers have gone up, it's probably still going to show that it's impaired for TDS work. All right. Have been adjusted. Now, down back to bacteria, evaluating the arrow. So what we've done in a couple, these are, again, proposed, we've done in a couple of these very salty inland water bodies is to go in and say, okay, what is the best bacteria method or bacterium to go after, to look at, to evaluate these water bodies? And you'll see there's Brazos River by the Possum Kingdom, Salt Fork the Brazos, and the Double Mountain Fork. All three of these segments are now being evaluated using Enterococcus, and the 33 colony-forming units per 100 milliliters is a long-term geometric mean. That's a very low number, and I don't know if we're going to be meeting that number. And EPA is reviewing it again. I think they're I have pretty recent rumblings about that, but it's really, really hard to meet. Okay. Several unclassified criteria, the assigned site-specific criteria, and I think I have a slide. Okay, site-specific criteria changes. So high aquatic life use is the aquatic life use that's relatively presumed across the state to be what you would expect a water body to meet. And so that's a 5 milligrams per liter DO average and a 3 milligrams per liter DO minimum. If you were to take 24 samples over 24 periods.
If it's perennial?
If it's, well, so we assume this, and if we get information to say that it is not a perennial water body, we wouldn't assess it using that. We would assess it using potentially an intermediate aquatic life use. But we also go into some of these water bodies that are even perennial, and we say, should they be considered a high aquatic life use? Should they be meet a 5 milligram per liter DO 24-hour average? Is that what they would meet no matter what was there in that water body? And so we go in and we do this extensive biological sampling, and we go and do lots of 24 or lots of dissolved oxygen sampling, and we try to see if it truly should still be considered a high aquatic life use and if it still should meet 5 milligrams per liter DO. I don't know if you remember us saying we're kind of separating in some cases the biology from the dissolved oxygen, and what we're doing is we're trying to say, yeah, these water bodies still meet the high aquatic life use, but they can't meet that DO. And so we'll say we're going to assess them using a lower dissolved oxygen criteria, but we're going to still say that they should meet a high aquatic life use. The bugs and the fish should be of high enough diversity and a number to meet. So these are the waters that we looked at that were new to this set, standard. And the ones that got changed to intermediate aquatic life use is these three. Now, this is North Fork Rocky Creek is the one that we talked about earlier. And when the flow is below 1.5 CFS, I said during the summer, that's basically what happens, then you'll look at a 2 milligram per liter average and a 1 milligram per liter minimum when the flow is that low. That's an update on site-specific criteria changes. Last one. Recreation use. So all water bodies are presumed to have a primary contact recreation use. And what we have been doing, and you've heard also about all these recreational use attainability analyses, REUAAs, and we're going in to see whether they should be considered high or high contact recreation use or primary. Oops, wrong button. Primary contact recreation. And then should they be secondary contact? One or two or non-contact. So 50 surveys were scheduled for the Brazos for 2009-2010. A lot of them have been completed. This water quality standards group that is in our section is still reviewing a lot of that information and trying to finalize some reports. So I don't believe any have actually gone out yet. Anybody know anything different?
You guys are waiting for EPA to make a decision on the standards before you come out with your final decision.
Okay. That's one of them definitely. Makes a difference because, yeah, I mean, if we don't have EPA saying we can have a secondary contact one, then we would not be willing to put that out there. Okay, implementation procedures, wastewater permitting. Now, standards is the water quality standards development, and they also have what goes into permits. And so they serve two purposes, and it's quite interesting for assessment versus wastewater permitting. So some of the proposed revisions, and I know not a whole lot about these, I'm afraid, but just to let you know, they're increasing their minimum analytical levels, or actually decreasing them, what they're saying that labs should meet for pollutant analysis for wastewater effluent. Whole effluent toxicity testing procedures, wet tests, a lot of people know a whole lot more about this than I do, and it's very controversial, but it is something that wastewater effluent has to be checked for. And critical low flows and streams to determine standard applicability. All these things are changes, and all of this is on the TCEQ website to get the details of this stuff. If you want to look for it, I'll show you the
our Clean Rivers program webpage, the main page is texascleanrivers.org, and down at the bottom, you just click on water quality standards, and you can get to this stuff. So, in detail. New procedures to evaluate the need for nutrient effluent limits for wastewater discharges. Now, we don't have new EPA nutrient criteria throughout the state. They are pursuing nutrient limits on effluent discharges around the state already. So that's already going into effect. And then dechlorination requirements. There's also some equality requirements. So nutrient criteria development. This is a big one. Our standards group is working very hard on this and trying to figure this out. Very difficult question and very difficult thing to figure out. There's two major options they're looking at. I don't think I skipped the slide. Okay. So option one for developing nutrient criteria is to look at the base criteria. What are the numbers we've got already? And base it on that. And saying, okay, all these water bodies, this is what really they should be expected to meet. Or looking at a stressor response analysis. And what that is saying, okay, did nutrients affect the dissolved oxygen in this water body, which affected the aquatic life use, which actually affected the use? Or did it affect, you know, dissolved oxygen because nutrients take up oxygen in order to go through the nitrogen cycle? And attached algae, that affects DO, can affect aquatic life. So basically by saying, okay, if your nutrients are causing an effect on these things, on a use, then we should have a criteria based on that. So that's a real difficult one. And the third option, which is kind of like sort of an option, it's a very difficult one, and this is kind of what Tiffany was alluding to, was incorporating models of loading and nutrient responses, which really is a TMDL or a watershed for nutrients, and that's a big, big challenge. So one of the things that our standards group said is a big challenge for all of us is that we have a lot of effluent-dominated streams. So how do you go and set criteria when you have a stream that's already not effluent? Our water quality assessment. Does anybody have any questions about this? This is a big deal right now.
Yeah, well, while you're there, Allison, I got a question. Some of the, it seems to me, just from an ecological basis, that you would need to do some kind of study to determine if these water bodies are nutrient or phosphorus limited. You know, I mean, if you're nutrient limited in one aspect, then you're thriving on another for your primary productivity and to kick off the whole life cycle. Is that type of analysis or a priori, you know, studies being planned?
Yeah, I mean, even at this point, when we've got certain
I said they're banking on phosphorus for the most part as being the primary
culprit. Right.
Right. But there are lots of situations where it'll actually switch.
Sure. Sure.
You know? And so they know that. They've got situations, I'm not going to name any specific ones, but where they've already identified that and said that. So it's like, do you deal with it on an effluent specific basis or, you know, with your wastewater evaluation for your watershed, or it's extremely complex, and they have a lot to try to figure out. That's a whole other side of it as well. Just trying to figure out. Yeah, I mean, it's all built in that question. Water quality assessment. I think someone already. I think Jenna covered this pretty well, saying we do this every 2 years. We look at the criteria. Does it meet? Does it not? If it doesn't meet, then we put it on our 303D list, which is our impaired water bodies list. Which is a section of the Clean Water Act, 303D, section 303D. Data is collected by Clean Rivers, region office staff, and other data providers throughout each basin. And period of record for the next assessment that we are hot and heavy working on, I'm not, but Jill is, will be December 1st, 2003 through November 30th, 2010. So it's a 7-year period. And we're going to be looking at having an advisory work group coming up. We're going to be looking at how water quality standards, if they get approved, will be incorporated. Options for assessing bacteria concentrations, handling data for load detection, and reservoirs of chlorophyll A criteria, which is basically part of
operating the new water quality standards. Watershed action planning. This is one of the major reasons I was going to talk to you today. This is a new initiative, although it's just basically what it is. It's bringing together all the different parts and pieces of the water quality improvement puzzle. It's what are you doing to improve water quality, and how are you doing it? And so we're trying to coordinate all these actions, get one place to put it all, and also track it, and make decisions. Get information, make decisions, track it. It seems pretty simple, but it's so many pieces and puzzle parts to the pie, to the puzzle, whatever, that we put a big effort into this in the last year or two to get this information, to get this whole thing going, and we are starting it out right now in our coordinated monitoring meetings. We are meeting to talk about not only what monitoring we're going to do, but also what information are we missing that's going to help us take that next step. That next step may not be the answer, but it's going to be a next step, and it's going to take us to the next step, and we're going to continue to track that. So this last bullet down here, meet with local stakeholders to get input on strategies for priority water bottles. That's where we're going to come back to you, stakeholder. After we get some information down on paper, we're kind of going down a road. We say, these are the options we think we're going to pursue. We're going to go back to the local stakeholders and we're going to say, which of these options do you think is the most viable for this watershed? And so we're going to want your input at that point. And we're going to go potentially to each watershed. These are just the priority ones, though, the ones that we can work on at any one time. If it's got something else going on, like an RUAA, we're not going to mess with it until we've got some information to do the next step. So those will probably be another year or two before we get back to those. So this is the process. Don't want to go through it in too much detail, just to let you know. We've done this top part, which is where a TCEQ gets together with its program staff, and we meet to talk about what are our water quality needs, data needs, and what are the current actions going on a water body. And then we come down to our coordinated monitoring meetings, which I said we're going to be having soon with VRA. We're going to talk about monitoring needs. We're going to be talking about what information can we collect at these meetings to tell us something that we need to use when we meet with our partners. And our partners, down here on the bottom, this is a state-level meeting, and we're going to say, okay, here's the strategies. Oh, no. These are the strategies that we've got highlighted for this watershed. Which of these do you think is the most viable? And then we say, okay, which of these do you think needs to go to stakeholders for their input? And that's when we go to the local watershed meetings. And then we start all over. Because things change, we get to the next step, and hopefully we will get to some point and have a final strategy for a water body. Just to let you know, the strategies that we have outlined, this is my last point, almost, our watershed evaluation and monitoring, where we don't know enough about what's going on in the watershed, we need to evaluate it more, get more data. TMDL, that's the total maximum daily load. That's saying how much load is assigned to each type of source, and then the implementation plan that says how we're going to address each type of source. And then watershed protection plan is like an implementation plan. It identifies all the sources in the water body. What are we going to do about it? What are our low-hanging fruit, we heard them say that. You know, what's the first thing we can do to improve this water body? And standards revision, that's another option. Those are those RUAAs and UAAs for aquatic life that say, do we need to take another look at this water body and say, is it really not meeting or is it actually still meeting its use? And then other, which is kind of we don't really dump too much in other. You might think, oh, let's just dump them all in other. We don't put a whole lot in there. But there's a few where we just don't know what to do with them. They're lingering, and it may be a permit issue, and it should go to enforcement. I don't know. Some situations. Anybody have any questions about that? Let me go back to the other slide. Watershed action planning. There's a person on my team named Patricia Wise, and she has been a big, big part of this whole process of defining it, meeting on it. I know it seems a little bureaucratic, but it really is important. We've got to coordinate our efforts. We've got to get our tracking down and what we need to do, set strategies, take action. That's what that's about. And again, again, here's our website, texascleanrivers.org. And what I've said down here is if you go to our website and you just go to the bottom of the page, there's a link on there to both the Water Quality Standards Group and the Surface Water Quality Monitoring Program. That Surface Water Quality Monitoring Program is where you get a hold of the assessment stuff. And the standard stuff is where you get a hold of what's changing with regard to the water quality. Anybody have any questions?
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jason Pinchback. I work with Texas Stream Team. We're part of River Systems Institute, located at Texas State University in San Marcos. I'd like to thank Ms. Barrett and the Brazos River Authority for allowing us to give a very brief presentation. Understanding we're the second to last bullet on the agenda, I'll keep this pretty brief for you all with their overview of the program. And we're a joint partnership with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, US EPA Region 6, and numerous partners across the entire state of Texas and many, many citizens. I'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge and recognize Michael Bales here and his wife. They're both veteran stream team monitors. They monitor five locations, both in the Possum Kingdom area as well as in the Trinity Basin. With our program, we do three main things. These focus in on citizen monitoring, non-point source, watershed outreach, and stakeholder engagement. Within the watershed education component, our services are pretty wide-ranging, everything from sponsoring booths to helping out at cleanups to sponsoring cleanups to developing curriculum or implementing or sharing our curriculum. We have curriculum available on the website. We also work in engaging stakeholders in local events that focus in on water quality issues or problems. This could include a press event. This could include a monitoring survey type of approach, but all of our outreach does focus in around watershed functions and non-point source pollution and prevention activities associated with day-to-day activities as well as everything that takes place between the home and the backyard and other things we do all out in the community. With our water quality monitoring component, our monitors are currently collecting information to address two types of questions. One would be an aquatic life use type of question. The other would be associated with contact recreation. So we're out sampling for dissolved oxygen, pH, conductivity, temperature, secchi depth transparency, flow severity, field observations, as well as E. coli. All of the data is noted in the right-hand side there. We're outside of the regulatory context, intended to be used for problem identification, local decisions, and various other activities, including research, education, and we hope to be working with partners to look at BMP effectiveness as well. Once a project is in place, maybe we can utilize this data to see how different BMP practices or an entire implementation strategy might be altering or improving water quality character. Here's a statewide map of all of our monitoring sites. The red dots essentially denote a monitoring location. And, of course, we're in one of the biggest basins here in the state, and I'll zoom in for that inset. This map shows 17 active sites and 110 inactive sites in the basin. We've recently added five sites, or around 22 active monitoring sites within the Brazos Basin. Some of the activities taking place over the last year would include we've got pretty much an annual working engagement with the Waco Wetlands at Lake Waco there, with teacher workshops, and we're engaging somewhere between 20 and 40 teachers with those workshops in Waco there. We've established recently four new sites at the Waco Wetlands, Bosque River, and Lake Waco, and we're activating a couple of sites on Sulphur Creek and in Land Passes based on local interest there. Coming up over the next couple of months, we have two trainings in the basin, and this would be with the Rio Brazos Master Naturalist Chapter in Lake Granbury, May 7th, as well as with the Upper Bosque Coalition in Eco Texas on April 9th. Just recently as well, we have a monitor in the lower part in the Georgetown, excuse me, in the Georgetown part of the basin, who's been recently responding to a pollution spill that was upstream of their location. She's an active veteran monitor who did monitor on her land, but she understood there's a sewage spill moving through her property, so she's been trained up on the E. coli and started training and monitoring for that. Something that's very touching and endearing, some folks might remember this couple here on the screen. You can't see Tony, but this is Berta and Tony Stanikinos. They were active monitors and group leaders with the Friends of Sulphur Creek for many, many years. And they both passed a number of years ago, but this last year in Lampasas, and this is the city of Lampasas, they had a giant watershed mural along with several other outreach components to it, basically put up onto the wall, and that was a community effort. And so they outlined the creek, the watershed, some of the different parts of the municipality. And so in honor of them, this outreach resource and kind of continuing that legacy, and it's really neat to see how small group of people can really make a long-lasting effort. And that's part of the cornerstone of our stream team participants and partners. Looking forward with the program, we are hopefully going to be releasing some new monitoring parameters to address some additional water quality concerns in the state, looking at both nitrates, phosphates, turbidity with a couple of different methods, as well as a rudimentary stream flow calculation, the old wiffle ball or orange method, but we're incorporating that into our methods as well. We are working on a data viewer, which will allow pretty much instant access for anybody, the general public, monitors, that will allow them to both enter the data as well as to query the data out. It'll be within a Google platform, so you can also utilize those resources to zoom in and look at the activities in the area. We're really excited about this. We're also hoping to build on a lot of efficiencies as we work with the partner network and reducing the need for everything to come through a central office, and that way we can be decentralized in that location. We think it will be quicker access to data and more accurate records as far as our client and record keeping behind the scenes. There's a lot of challenges associated with working with partners, and everybody has a lot of priorities out there. We also have released this last year a new set of monitoring videos. These are kind of training refresher videos, where the monitor can access instantly the different parameters. And we're also going to utilize this resource to segue into a quality control self-assessment as well that we're working on to be completed within this next 8 months. And just all these small things to improve the quality of our data are very important for folks who are using it out there. We have a biannual event called Meeting of the Monitors. It's taking place in the Houston area at Clear Lake. We're partnering up with the Houston-Galveston area Council Governments, and it's going to be late September, and it's going to be a three-day conference. Part of it is going to be focused on Thursday with the HGAC's Clean Water Initiative. Our Friday is going to have a several theme focus with the morning addressing how do areas which are urbanizing, how do they preemptively work with this development, and we're going to have both an urban as well as an agriculture and a rancher's perspective on that. The afternoon, we're going to do some stakeholder facilitation training, as well as a very general look on leveraging citizen resources to help implement various programs and projects across the board. And then our Saturday is going to be pretty much a day full of hands-on workshops and continuing education. Another resource that we provide are our data reports, and these are all this information is available on our website also, but our data reports basically summarize the water quality data that's out there. This might be just several sites on a stream. This could be a larger report that might be 110 pages, for instance. But it's just a way to access the data. We have these reports as well as raw data files, and these are also available on our website if you'd like to take a look at what we have. One of the other things that we're really lucky to be a part of Texas State University, and we're working with them to develop an iPhone application, smartphone application, which monitors will have. If you have a smartphone, you're going to be able to basically enter data in the field, look at videos, find contact information. If you find a concern or what's going on at your site, we'll have a series of different contact information, numbers, and that type of stuff, and help the monitor determine what course of action or how to help operate the decision tree if they do find an issue. And this would include everything, for instance, from calling your local river authority, county, municipality, kills and spills line, et cetera, et cetera. So we kind of ramp up from call your partner all the way to call someone who would respond to a kill and spill if that's the situation. This will also allow for a GPS coordinates to be clocked as well as photos out in the field, which will be able to be sent directly into our offices. Finally, as we have seen today, there's been a lot of different water quality concerns and issues across the basin here, and it's that way across the state. So Texas Stream Team is here to inform you about our activities and also to invite opportunities if you see ways that perhaps your priorities and goals intersect with ours. We want to work with you and try to figure out how we can utilize our trained citizen monitors out there and our outreach services to work collectively together and ideally restore our water quality habitats and water quality conditions. This, incidentally, is an older picture from Jacob's Well. It's the headwaters of Cypress Creek in the Wimberley area. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present. We've completed everything internally, and University IT is submitting it to the Apple Store. And I've never done this before, so I don't know if it's something they turn around in 3 days or if it takes 3 months. It's going to be a free application, and we're launching our data viewer database in September. And either way, we certainly hope to be able to launch this right alongside. Thank you all very much.
Okay. I only really have one more slide. It's not a whole talk left. But on my tentative agenda, I had a little update on zebra mussels in Texas. And Jennifer Bronson has just a little update for us.
Jennifer Bronson with Texas Parks and Wildlife. On April 3rd, 2009, the first zebra mussel was found in Lake Texoma. In August 3rd, 2009, they found live adults in Sister Grove Creek, which is what feeds into Lake Levan. The Sister Grove Creek zebra mussel population is downstream from the North Texas Municipal Water District transfer pipeline. Pending those new arrivals, which is unfortunate for Texas, in September of 2010, Inland Fisheries went up to Sister Grove Creek and treated the creek with potassium chloride, which is basically salt. They don't do well in salt. They dosed it again in October of 2010, and when they went back to reevaluate in November of 2010, they did find they had killed a lot of the adult zebra mussels, but it did not get all of the adult zebra mussels. So we were trying to hope to get to eradicate the creek so that we wouldn't introduce it to Levan, just to kind of stop it in its tracks. Kind of what's happening with the adult population in the stream is it's just going to depend on time. So we're going back in the summer to reevaluate the status of the zebra mussels in Sister Grove Creek. But the department has been working with the marinas, local agencies, water districts. They've got, you know, TV commercials, radio commercials, press, brochures, out in the area, signs at boat ramps at Texoma and Levan to help keep spreading the mussels to other water bodies or lakes within the state. Their biggest thing that they're working on right now is marketing to ensure people know about zebra mussels and know how to clean their boats. Several larger marinas in Texoma already have decontamination units to where they have the high-power washing units with the hot water that actually will kill the zebra mussel, its villagers and stuff. So we're working really hard to keep it maintained. We just really need to make sure we have enough funding for the marketing strategy to help educate the public about how to clean your boat, how not to spread it, and you know, to make sure people know it's there. As far as the population in Texoma, it's definitely established. It's there. It's covering almost of the majority of the reservoir. Sister Grove Creek, last year, there is a guy from the USGS who's doing monitoring, and he found that the villagers last summer in Sister Grove Creek were not healthy looking. We're not sure what that means, but that's why we're going to go back and reassess and see if how the population is doing in Sister Grove Creek after the treatment. So I think that's about it. Do y'all have any questions? No. Our other invasive species of interest is the giant salvinia, which is in Caddo Lake. And we're also actively working with them to try to keep that plant under control. That I know that my cohort, Adam Wisnat, and Tyler works a lot with them in Caddo trying to work on keeping that under control. So any questions? Fantastic.
Okay, and that is basically it. This last slide, I just wanted to remind y'all, I left some of our 2010 Basin Highlights reports out on the table in case anybody wanted one that didn't get one from last year. And this actually is draft, the 2011 report, and that may be the picture we use. I'm not sure where it was or if Nick may know where, but it was taken on a biological somewhere last year. So it's from the Brazos River Basin. But anyway, usually I just say, oh, you know, go on the website and, you know, look at the report if you want. But this year I'll send out everyone an email and link and, you know, mail anyone a copy that wants one. So anyway, just a reminder. And with that, unless anybody has any other questions about anything, that will be the end of the meeting for this year. That it? Okay, well, thank y'all so very much for coming, and we look forward to seeing y'all again next year.
I enjoyed your presentation.
Did you? All right.
You guys have any additional meetings or you don't have any additional
stakeholders?
Like, do you live in Austin now? Yeah. And then you worked in Colorado for a while?
Yeah. I'll try to look at it and figure it out.
Are you going to practice that?
Maybe it's his last Stephen F. Austin. 2001?
Hi, Richard.
Are you here, too? Yeah.
I live in Colorado. I will. I'm the last one. Okay.
I worked full time. I made a 90 something in the class and didn't make a C. Was on the extended plan and didn't graduate. So, Did you know Pete Bell? He's a big, tall man. David Hackett. They're a little bit older.
Some of the guys, of course, you guys under 40s, he's a big,
it's kind of funny. I go through and I read the guy's face and every once in a while I feel like it. But, you know, I don't know how many people out there. I was, I guess because I worked so much, I didn't know anybody in the department. And I guess the only, and I don't know if she still works that season or not, but it's a GD. I can't remember the last name. No, she was older. She was a graduate student.
Melissa Parker.
Yeah. I don't know who that
she's
is.
Yeah. Parks, yeah. She's big and rough.
Yeah. I talked to him not too long ago. I was asking him about, I guess there's a big push to go through and reclassify wetland species.
Sure.
And anyway, I called to talk to him because he's on a phone to him. Just kind of ask him about implications and whatever else. Well, they're changing the entire system of how they do their science. And I was trying to read up on it. I had messed with that so long. But,
Good times, sir.
I live in
French Quarter.
Did you really?
Yeah, I know.
Good
parties
over there. Well, we hosted everyone. There were 13 apartments. Everyone had examined the apartment. And we put a tarp on both ends and just let people come in. Since it was enclosed, we didn't get rated or whatever. People parked over at the Eckerd's behind us.
Oh, okay. Right down from the college. I never had a problem taking the day before class. So, throw a rock.
I got several tickets driving over there. Usually I rode my bike.
Yeah.
I live, let's say, across, and then we had a house the second year I was there. But I got several tickets parked over there. I parked over by the athletic or the
fields over there?
Yeah, the athletic fields. Back on the other side by the forest park.
The gym,
little workout room.
Yeah. Like I said, if I could have made any money out there, I'd apply for some jobs in Temple Inland.
I left the day I graduated. I didn't go to graduation. I was so ready to get back. I grew up in Central Texas. I like the area. Really, actually, I like further west. And I fly to some jobs in Colorado, some in New Mexico. But they're mostly other jobs and that experience. Not being a minority woman, I didn't have a whole lot of chance to get those. And anyway, I got hired on to the soil conservation and ag stuff. I had no intention of working in agriculture. I just fell in love with it. And I grew up in a small community. I said I was going to do ag and raise cows and whatever else. Yep, sure is. I don't get to meet too many SFA grads out in the professional world.
There's quite a bit that I'm friends with. Some that I don't even know, get spoke to. It's quite a few folks, especially from the college, a lot of it.
Out east, there's a whole lot more, I guess.
Yeah.
Than, 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 than,
right.
You know Lori Hamilton?
Yeah, that's a small world.
I didn't know Lori went to, did she graduate from that? Yeah.
Bacteria. You know, she's on the standards group.
Yeah, yeah. I've been working pretty well.
Actually, I met her classes with her.
Probably did.
Yeah, if she did, she would.
Get him down. What about me, mister?
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate it. That's why you're so good at it then.
So you move up. I thought you were going to get a presentation or something. I said, no bad.